Joining us on the Chris Collinsworth podcast, Mr. Eric Eager, the guy that every NFL team wants to have in their hip pocket, and we won't let him go. We just keep paying him millions and millions of dollars, and he's the guy that keeps all things interesting at PFF. He is our senior data analyst and comes up with all the great things you see on our website, and we are lucky to have him. Mr. Eric Eager, how are you, brother?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited for this weekend of conference championship. I can't believe we're already here, but man, it's been a fun season and we've learned a lot.
We have learned a lot. How about college football last weekend? Michigan and Jim Harbaugh finally knock off Ohio State, and we're in Cincinnati, so it's not like I was cheering for it, but that's exactly what happened. So Michigan pops into the playoff race here at number two. Cincinnati stays at four, Georgia stays at one, and Alabama with a miracle win against Auburn, in which if their running back is not pushed out of bounds and the clock keeps running, Alabama has 20 seconds to deal with at the end of the game instead of a minute and whatever it was. But Alabama has a perfect final drive, goes down the field, wins the football game, so they remain at three, and now it is Alabama and Georgia matching up in the SEC championship game. And this gets really interesting from my standpoint. Let's say Alabama beats Georgia. I'm not saying they will. I'm not betting that. I'm not doing anything. But if Alabama were to beat Georgia, now everybody ranked ahead of UC, who is undefeated, and we're going to assume for the minute that they win their conference championship, everybody would have one loss, and Alabama would have a win the prior weekend or the prior championship weekend over Georgia. So I think it would go Alabama, Georgia or Michigan, Michigan or Georgia, UC, and that would be your playoffs. But unbelievably, Alabama would come back from what looked like a sure second loss to being the number one overall seed in these playoffs. Do you see it that way, or do you see something completely different?
Yeah, I think we've seen the committee, you know, not necessarily take losses in some cases seriously, right? There was a couple weeks ago when both Michigan had one loss and Michigan State had zero, and they had Michigan ranked ahead of Michigan State, right? Just because I think we all sort of could see that Michigan was the better team, and they did that. But at the same time, they had Oregon ahead of Ohio State because Oregon beat Ohio State in week like one or two. And so they've been kind of inconsistent there. So I can see the committee, let's say Alabama wins a three-point game or whatever. Everybody looks and says, yeah, well, Georgia's been more impressive this year. We'll still give them the one seed. We'll give Alabama the two seed. But yeah, you're right. I mean, because you sort of, I think when you were talking, you kind of gave the impression, and it's true, that the difference between the two and three seed is basically nothing, right? Because you don't get home field advantage and two plays three no matter what. It is really a big deal who gets the one seed, though, because, well, you know, it's going to be uncharted waters. We have in our simulation, if Alabama were to win, Georgia and Alabama are in 100% of the time. So we have it baked in that Georgia makes it no matter what. Michigan would be a 65% chance to make it. Basically, they have to beat Iowa. And then Cincinnati has a 64% chance to make it, and basically they have to beat Houston. And again, but the difference, like who gets to play Cincy, a team we've never seen play in the college football playoff, versus who has to grind it out with Michigan, you know, they'll still be favorites, but it's not nearly, I think, as favorable of a matchup. It's a really big deal.
So who's favored in the Georgia-Alabama game?
Yeah, actually, this is a very interesting one, right? So going into the week, you know, sports books like Circa, they posted a line of Georgia being about a 3-point favorite, which is sort of where we had them. And after watching the Iron Bowl, they made this line a 6.5-point spread. So Alabama is almost a full touchdown underdog in this game.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. That's interesting. And are we convinced now with the big showing by Michigan that that's a legitimate football team? If in fact they knock off Iowa, and is Oklahoma State sitting there fully capable of jumping in? Obviously, if UC or or Alabama or Michigan were to lose, I think any of those would be out, and if Oklahoma State wins, would be in. And then, of course, you have Notre Dame sitting right behind them, sans coach now with Brian Kelly
Right.
going to LSU. We're going to get into that. We're also going to, just so you don't think this is going to be all college football, we're going to get into one interesting discussion about the mathematics of NFL football that I'm completely enthralled with. I've been spending all day thinking about this thing. But I do want to finish up this point. So I think any of those teams, of the four teams other than Georgia, if Georgia gets beat by Alabama, they're still going to be in.
Yep.
But if Michigan, Alabama, or UC got beat and Oklahoma State won, I think Oklahoma State would be in. Tell me now what would have to happen, in your opinion, for the Irish to make this playoff.
It's a great
Two of
one.
them?
It's probably that. Like we and for the we have the PFF Live College Football Show, which is every Friday. We're doing kind of a what if of our simulation. So I already have some of these numbers. We have Notre Dame with a 46% chance to make it, and that actually seems pretty high, right? Because essentially, what you need is for something bad to happen. But if you think about it the other way, and you and I, we understand gambling quite a bit. Like they just need one bad thing to happen, Notre Dame, right? They need either Alabama to lose, Cincinnati to lose, Michigan to lose, Oklahoma State to lose, right? And like the chances that none of those happen is actually fairly small, right? Like we see upsets every single week in college football. The last week, I think, is a prime example of that. So, I think the cleanest way for them is for Alabama to lose to Georgia convincingly. We still give Alabama a 23% chance to make the college football playoff with two losses. That would be unprecedented, but they are loved, and if they lose, like let's say a field goal game, they could probably still make it. But to me, it's a combination. I mean, obviously, Houston's a live team against Cincinnati. Alabama could very well lose to Georgia, and then Oklahoma's a live team against Baylor. I know Baylor's Oklahoma State, I'm sorry, their quarterback is injured, but Baylor has had some good wins this year. So to me, it's some combination of one or two of those teams losing, which isn't all that improbable.
Yeah, it would be hard for me, unless it were just a thrilling game between Alabama and Georgia, where you were just begging for a rematch. Two losses makes it really tough to leave out a whole conference, you know? And it's not that they aren't one of the four best teams, but you kind of like that cross section, right? Of seeing everything happened and seeing everybody sort of have a chance. And the loss to by the Irish to University of Cincinnati completely justifies that one. But if UC looked great, Alabama got beat, Oklahoma State got beat, could you jump the Irish in over Alabama, who Alabama always whips Notre Dame pretty badly when they get head to head in one of those things? It's just a really interesting bit of math here. And once again, you're never sure you got the best four teams in there at the end of the year. Notre Dame's red hot, right? UC's had a bunch of close games against much lesser competition. In Michigan, I don't know how good that conference is. I just don't.
Yeah, we make Notre Dame about 8 points worse than Alabama on a neutral field, which actually is not that bad considering like where Notre Dame started the season, as you said, some non-convincing wins against teams like Toledo and then of course a big loss to Cincinnati. But like if you think about the rate of change for these two teams, like Alabama has not been impressive since they lost to Texas A&M, right? And so I do think you can make an argument that Notre Dame might not be the better team, but they're more deserving, certainly. And they've done nothing but take care of business, for the last two, basically 2 months. So I could very much see them, especially considering they're a blue blood in the eyes of many. If you took the exact same players and slapped, let's say, Pittsburgh on them or Oklahoma or some other like non, like storied, you know, franchise in college football, then I think they make less of a case, right? But since it is Notre Dame, I don't think the committee would have that big of a problem, except for the Brian Kelly thing, which sort of throws a wrench in all this discussion.
Money, 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 money. So let's get into this thing, because clearly Notre Dame would bring a lot more money to this playoff than would Cincinnati. Let's just be honest. That Notre Dame's sort of that national draw that we talk about. No Brian Kelly. He goes to LSU. No Lincoln Riley. I want to talk about cash for a little while. We are now seeing for the first time, and it happened at Michigan State as well with their coach, these $100 million contracts being passed around, where we're beginning to get, and this is going to make some people crazy, the true value of these coaches. And the reason I say that, whether it's a coach or a quarterback, is that try and imagine how much money the football team at Alabama has made for the general scholarship fund for that university, for recruiting of top students to that university, for research dollars, whatever you want to say. And I've told this one before, but I one time made the comment that I'll bet when Kentucky wins the national championship, they double their money as it comes into the general scholarship fund. I took on talk radio, I said that. So like I took for 2 hours straight, the most abuse I've ever taken over anything. You're out of your mind. You have no idea what you're talking about. So the next day I call Kentucky and they go, listen, we can't go on the record. We can't say anything like that. But you want to know what the number is? I said, yeah, five times the amount of donation to the general scholarship fund when their basketball team wins the national championship.
It happens in Division II. Like when I was going to college, the school like Winona State, which is in southeast part of Minnesota, won three straight Division II basketball championships. And the exact same thing happened. Literally every like kid that, I mean, it's the same thing, no matter what level of football. It's crazy, but you're absolutely right. And that's, you know, and you have to look and ask like who's generating that value.
For sure. So did it surprise you first Lincoln Riley leaving Oklahoma to go to USC? Did any of that, because it looked like, you know, we didn't know exactly where he was going to go. There were rumors flying all over the place about him, but Lincoln Riley's had a really legitimate run and is considered one of the top offensive coaches in all the land. And I can tell you the Dallas Cowboys were very much interested in the possibility of him being the head coach of the Cowboys at one time. Anything about that surprise you?
It did. Like, and I talked to this over with our friend George Shahuri, who's very like in tune with what LA is. And I guess I had underestimated the appeal of USC just because, you know, we've had the college football playoff for years now, and we've only had one Pac-12 team ever make it after Oregon made it the first year. And so like, for me, I'm kind of like, well, what's the appeal there? Like, I don't necessarily know. But after you peel it back a little bit, it does make a little bit of sense, right? Because Oklahoma is not going to compete in the SEC for that long, right? Like it's going to take a while. We see Missouri, for example, you know, have their years. They've had decent seasons, but they're nowhere close to competing with Alabama, Auburn, Georgia, those types of teams. And that's where Lincoln Riley's going, right? He also has to compete with Texas there. And so if he's going to be starting over at his current job, why not start over at a different job is kind of the way I think he might see it. And then you add to that the resources he's going to get and the possibility. And you look back in the, you know, the aughts and how much Pete Carroll sort of controlled the narrative of college football. You know, I think I'm now that I was surprised when it first came out, because, you know, as somebody who follows Pac-12 football, it's kind of like, oh, USC is kind of meh. But like there is that potential there. And if he had to give up what it was kind of going to be, in my opinion, somewhat of a sinking ship in Oklahoma going to the big, to the SEC, I think it makes sense in hindsight.
Then Brian Kelly, I think that may have been the biggest surprise of all for most people. He lands at LSU and he lands one of those $100 million contracts, where I think most people were of the opinion that What's Brian going to coach? Another couple of years, retire, be comfortable, be the all-time winningest coach at Notre Dame. And then he bounces to LSU, and so you bounce into the Tigers' cage down there too. The expectations now after with a contract like that, and that program's been slipping. And they let go of a coach who had a few off the field indiscretions as well, but had won a national championship just a couple of years ago with Joe Burrow.
Yeah, that's the thing is I think when you look at Kelly's tenure in Notre Dame, do you get the impression that it's sort of plateaued, right? Like they've from a talent standpoint, they're always going to be in the mix, but there's always these constant reminders that they're not quite where they need to be, right? Like last year, they win a game against Clemson early November, where they had DJ Uiagalelei starting. And then they get them again in the ACC title game and they get blown out, right? A constant reminder. There was obviously the national championship game, and I believe in 13, where they got kind of run out of the building in that game because they weren't able to sort of compete on an athletic level. And so I think that there's something, a lot of these guys, and being, I mean, being a Pro Bowler and a professional athlete and all that stuff, like there's that drive, right, to want to continue to get better, because if you're kind of staying the same, you're getting worse, right? And I think for him, I think he probably saw the plateau at Notre Dame and thought, okay, if I'm going to win a national championship, because that's really all he has left to do, I'm going to have to go somewhere where I can recruit athletes that can compete with the Alabamas and the Georgias and the Clemsons of the world. And obviously the other part of it is the money. And I followed up Tim Grunhardt on a radio station in Kansas City yesterday, where he and Grunhardt's, went to Notre Dame and is a donor and stuff. And he gave off the impression that Kelly had approached Notre Dame about an extension, and it was sort of like lukewarm, the response. And so I do think part of it was also just like, sometimes it's just amicable, right? Where it's like, hey, there's Marcus Freeman in the wings, and he might not be as expensive, but he might be just as talented of a coach. For other places, it might not be as simple, but maybe it was something where Kelly had worn out his welcome too, and maybe Notre Dame looking at, okay, we could pay him $100 million, keep him, or we can, charter a new, path here with somebody else. Maybe that second part's more appealing.
And Marcus Freeman maybe gets the job at Notre Dame over a Luke Fickell. And does Luke Fickell now get hurt in some way by the fact that he's playing in the Final Four and maybe not doing the world tours here of the coaching carousel?
Maybe, but I mean, we've seen coaches at the college level have pop-ups and then regress a little bit and then still get the plum job. I mean, even Lincoln Riley's that exact case. I mean, Oklahoma hasn't made the college football playoff for two consecutive years and he got the job he wants, So, like let's say Fickell's Cincinnati Bearcats get blown out in the college football playoff. And then, like, let's say they don't come close to making it next year. I don't think his stock falls out that much, right? And so, it might not be the exact job like Notre Dame or whatever, but if he starts seeing stars and wants a $100 million deal, I don't think that delaying it 1 year will be a big deal. I mean, we even saw it with Cliff Kingsbury. I mean, Kingsbury didn't even have a winning record at Texas Tech. He gets the offensive coordinator job at USC and then turns that down to get the Cardinals head coaching job. Like, I think we don't necessarily look all to results, and especially the most immediate results, when we pick coaches for programs.
All right, I can't wait to get to our analytics discussion at the end of this thing. So, but I do want to begin, if I can find it on my telephone again, which I feel like that's all I end up doing anymore, just flipping through all my notes and things that I want to talk about. I'm going to get to the very top end of this thing and exactly what's going on with the National Football League right now. So, I saw Baltimore, right? We saw them against Cleveland. And they played a great defensive game. Don't want to take that away. Cleveland's been struggling on offense anyway. And Baltimore sitting there as the number one seed with an 8-3 record. And yet you watch the game and you go, is that really the best team in the AFC? Because sitting there down the list a little bit are the New England Patriots, who have won six in a row right now. and have a quarterback who is 85% accurate, the number one guy in the league, in Mac Jones. Tennessee now drops all the way down to number three, trying to play without Henry or their two star running backs in this game, AJ Brown and Julio Jones. All of a sudden, the Chargers look beatable. Buffalo's at 7-4. They get their swing at the Patriots this week. It is the AFC appears to be sort of the upper tier. There's not going to be a bad record that gets in. But is there a team that now you look at and you go, oh boy, you're in trouble if you play against them? That all of a sudden, that's the New England Patriots?
It kind of is, by the way. Everybody's talking about Coach of the Year, and you got to see this guy acutely on Sunday night. I think it's John Harbaugh, right? Like, that team has no one on it anymore, and they can somehow gut out these wins. They're third to last in the NFL in yards per play allowed on defense. So even their like historical calling card, it has eroded a little bit, and they just find ways to win. I do think like that's, you know, obviously we talk about LaFleur, we talk about guys like that. I think John Harbaugh is earning his money as much as anybody in the National Football League this year. Insofar as the Patriots, I'll say this about the Patriots. You know, they have the 31st most difficult schedule to this point, right? So there's some impressive wins on there, but there's also wins against the New York Jets twice, the Carolina Panthers, the Houston Texans, and they are ascending. This season has been one where the hottest team is the most likely team to lose that week. And so I'll pump the brakes. They do have Buffalo twice, surrounded by going to Indianapolis. And that brings me to the team that actually makes me nervous if I'm an AFC team. I think the Colts and I think the
Agreed.
Colts just compete. And like, how much different would this season be if Indianapolis would have finished off Baltimore on Monday Night Football, if they would have kept a two touchdown lead at home against Indy and lost that, or sorry, against Tennessee, lost that game in overtime. And then obviously this last game where they turned the ball over five times despite really outplaying Tampa Bay. Like, there's a chance Indy doesn't even make the playoffs. But if they make it, I think that they have kind of this like, they're smart enough. I think Frank Reich's fantastic. I think, you know, their analytics guys are smart. They never screw up fourth downs. Like, and their defense is solid. They're a team that I just don't want to face. Like, they're physical. You know, Carson Wentz is playing great football, I think. That's a team where I think if you're looking for a dark horse in this conference, that's the one. But I do agree. I think New England's also on that list of teams that like I would fear facing in the playoffs right now. I just worry for them. Are they peaking too early?
Yeah, you know, and who knows, the rookie quarterback, maybe he'll be that much better by the end of the season. The Kansas City Chiefs, though, if you want to look at the team that is hot, and they're hot, not their as their offense is getting better. That's about all you can say about their offense right now. The defense is absolutely carrying the load. And if you put any kind of defense with the Kansas City Chiefs and what they could be on the offensive side, especially considering that they completely remade that offensive line, have two rookies starting on that offensive line. That gets interesting. And Cincinnati just blew the hell out of the Pittsburgh Steelers out of the water. And you go, if you're looking around at young offensive weapons, is there a better group than what Cincinnati's put together?
Oh, and I think even one of the weaknesses that they've had long standing is their defense. And they've built the defense, I think, the way that PFF would advise them to, you know, buy a lot of players in the secondary, hope five or six of them work out, which they mostly have, you know, get, you know, good deals as pass rushers. And I think Hendrickson is that guy. And, you know, even some of the guys that they've gotten, like Ogunjobi and so forth, they've been great. The one thing about your Bengals, though, Chris, they've played the easiest schedule to date. They have the third hardest schedule left. So we give them a 36% chance to win the AFC North. That would be the first time since 2015, but that's the highest mark other than Baltimore. We give them a 4% chance to win the Super Bowl for the first time. So they're a team that we're taking very seriously. I think Joe Burrow, you know, especially we've been so, I think, spoiled by quarterbacks coming into the league and playing well, that when a few of them don't, like this year, it makes me appreciate Joe Burrow and how good he's been in his first 2 years more, you know, because, you know, it's tough to compare him to Mahomes and Herbert and guys like that, but like to compare him to other first and second year quarterbacks, he's been wonderful.
Well, and think about what he's done. I mean, he hurt his knee late in the season last year. Mm-hmm. A lot of people said this was a horrible injury. He was going to really, he may never come back from this thing. That sucker from day one has stood in the pocket, taken hits, didn't blink, and their three receivers can play. Joe Mixon can play. They're an interesting bunch. They really are. In the NFC, I tend to almost forget about Arizona sitting on top of the whole list. You know, because you think of, all right, who's the team to beat? And most people would say, all right, you know, Aaron Rodgers is going to Tom Brady. You're sitting there at 2 and 3. And yet it is Arizona who's kept it together despite losing Kyler Murray for a pretty significant bit of time here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, has anybody made himself more long-term money over the last 4 weeks than Colt McCoy? Like, I feel like every one of those third down completions he had against Seattle were $50 million lifetime earnings passes, right? Like, what a gem there. Yeah, I think when you look at the NFC, I'm more convinced that these teams are good, but I'm less convinced that I know who's going to make the Super Bowl out of it. Don't you agree? Like, I'm convinced I'm convinced Green Bay is good. I'm just not sure, you know, when push comes to shove, if they run into a team with a deep secondary, can they get guys open, much like last year? I'm convinced that Tampa's good, but, you know, will their run pass ratios be good enough in the playoffs to win? I'm convinced Arizona's good, but I haven't seen their quarterback play in a month, so I don't know. And I am actually convinced Dallas is good. But I just don't know which Dak Prescott we're going to get. I think Dak Prescott on average is amazing, but he has some variance to his play. So that one's interesting, I think, for a different reason, right?
And then you've got OBJ and Von Miller coming in and playing with Aaron Donald and company. But the Rams are falling. And apparently Matthew Stafford is messed up from an injury standpoint. The Cowboys without their receivers. Tampa Bay still playing without Antonio Brown. You can say anything you want. That team got hot last year when Antonio Brown came in, and Brown got more targets than anybody. But it's almost a crack up to me now that San Francisco is finally playing the way that everybody thought they would. And all of a sudden, Jimmy Garoppolo is kind of becoming a little bit of the flavor of the month. And, oh, by the way, the Washington football team would now be in the playoffs if they were held today. I mean, this is some bizarre stuff. And I think the seventh team being added to the playoffs takes some mental getting used to, especially in the NFC, because every bad team is still alive. Where it somehow, when they went from 6 to 7, you know, 6, it seemed like the bad teams were just kind of forgotten earlier in the year. I think for regular season interest, the 7th team is actually keeping it a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, and it was that way in baseball when they put that second wild card in. It was like the whole month of August became alive. And I think the same thing's true about December and January in the NFL now. You know, especially like you think about the AFC's fine. I think the 7th seed in the AFC is going to be a good football team. I don't think the way about the NFC, like Atlanta right now is tied for the 7th seed. They've been outscored by their opponents by over 100 points this year. Washington's had their issues. Minnesota's the best team of that bunch, but we all have seen the Vikings do this before. And obviously even a team like Philadelphia who, you know, they have a prime, you know, chance here. They have the 30th most difficult schedule moving forward. So literally they just have to put one foot in front of the other and probably make the playoffs here. It's just that when presented that opportunity Sunday against the Giants, they couldn't do that. And so it really makes for an interesting month. I agree. I'm excited about that. Even if, you know, that team's probably going to get waxed by Tampa Bay, Arizona, or Green Bay in the first, the first weekend of the playoffs.
Football fans, we all love an action-packed, high-scoring NFL game, but with a no-brainer from DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL, you'll bet once a single point is scored. New customers bet just one on any team to score can win $100 in free bets. It's just that simple.
If Sportsbook isn't available in your state yet, you can still get in on the NFL action. Everyone can play for huge cash prizes all season long with DraftKings Daily Fantasy Sports Contests. DraftKings is giving all new customers a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes, and all with their first deposit. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code PFF and bet $1 on any team to score and win $100 in free bets. If they score, you score with promo code PFF. This week at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Must be 21 or older, New Jersey, Indiana, or Pennsylvania. New customers, minimum $5 deposit, $1 wager required. One per customer. Restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Whether it's football success or financial savvy, the right questions help set the stage for winning strategies. Western and Southern is teaming up with PFF to share insights that can help put you ahead on both your fantasy and financial scoreboards. You can ask me anything. Whatever you need to know, you can also find out about your financial future. So ask either or both, doesn't matter. Every football or financial question you ask earns you a chance to win a catered party February's big game, and we all know what that is. PFF will throw a party worth up to $2,100 for the big game in February, and the winner can choose whatever food they want, up to $2,500 for you and 25 other guests. That'll be great. Check out the Chris Collinsworth podcast and Western and Southern's Instagram for answers to the best questions each week. And this week, Laura in the great state of Florida, she asks, what other career would you be in if not for football? That's a really good question. I was in law school. I graduated from the University of Cincinnati Law School. It took me a little bit of extra time. It took me 5 years instead of 3 years because I was doing it while I played football. But yeah, that's what I always thought I was going to be. And then when I got cut by the Bengals in 89, then I was just going back to school. And then I got a call from HBO, asked me if I wanted to do features. And I said, sure. How much does it pay? And they told me, and I said, just one other question, what's a feature? And that's how my television career started right there. Then I got a call from the radio station. I got a call from NBC. I don't really know how it all happened, but I figured it would last about 1 or 2 years. I'd pay for law school, go back to being an attorney. But for whatever reason, I'm still cranking along here with this craziness. But Laura, thanks for the question. You can submit your question at westernsouthern.com/askchris, and it's C-R-I-S. I know. One more time, that is westernsouthern.com/askcris. And if you're watching on YouTube, check out the link in the description below. Remember, with Western and Southern, you can rest assured on game day. Right now, you can get 40% off any PFF subscription, if you use Cyber40, C-Y-B-E-R 40. Grades and data are live for every single player who logged a snap last week. Go check out the highest graded players from week 12 and look to find early value on spread picks and player props for week 13. What can you get with the PFF subscription? Good question. All of PFF's locked article content is a lot of stuff. PFF's NFL and college football betting dashboards, our grade-powered projections, cover probabilities, and betting values. 0 to 100 grades on every single player, including the top rookies on every team. Player prop tools, which shows plus-minus value for every NFL prop, and there's a lot of those. And a whole lot more. So support the podcast. Help me pay all these great young people that are working with us and use promo code Cyber40 for 40% off any sub.
All right. We are going to do something now that we haven't done. We talk general football, results of football, all the different things. Eric is a former math professor and data analytics expert. And he writes all these papers, enters contests for MIT, and gets through to the finals, and he's a brilliant guy. You took a very simple concept, right? Run versus pass. It's something we've all talked about. You know, some coaches, you know, I can remember Andy Reid back in the day used to throw 60% of the time. And I swear we all thought he was out of his mind. Everybody thought Andy Reid was crazy for doing this. It ends up Andy Reid must have been a mathematician too, because it really mathematically is the right way to go. Now, it's a lot easier for me to say that than it is to explain the math behind that. So we have a video that you put together that we will run now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the math of decision making in the National Football League. You ready for this?
Welcome to today's edition of the PFF Analytics Short. Today we're going to talk about the run versus the pass. And I know that this is a tired discussion in the football and football analytics community, but I think we're going to approach it from the right perspective here, which is to look, as it always should, with the offensive line here. So let's look at why coaches love running the football so much. And it starts with the offensive line. So if you look at, you know, let's say, you know, a standard, you know, offense here where you have a quarterback here and you have, you know, a running back here and a tight end there. And again, you want to look at, you know, maybe, you know, blocking the men up front here to get a run play going. We at PFF grade every single player on every single play, and that includes run and pass blockers. And in a run game, what we've shown and what we've found is that if every single player along the offensive line blocks up perfectly, we give each of these players a passing grade on a play, a run play is the best play in football. It gets a 60% success rate. It has an expected points added of 0.27. So you're getting a quarter of a point every time you execute one of these plays. And that's as good as it gets. The best teams in offensive football do not average these numbers over the course of a season, run or pass. The problem is, and this is where, again, we get to some of the nuance, the moment that one of these check marks becomes an X, the moment that one of these blockers gets defeated, this turns poorly for an offense. 60% becomes more like 26%. Positive 0.27 becomes negative 0.27. So you lose one half of 1 point the moment that a player doesn't execute a block in the run game. Contrast this with the passing game. Contrast this with the passing game. The passing game, of course, you know, blocking up, you know, players in the passing game is clearly valuable. And if you block up everybody in the pass game, your success rate is 54% and your expected points added is 0.20. The problem is the drop-off isn't nearly as substantial in the passing game. With the first negative block or more, you drop to 43% success rate. That's actually fine. That's actually roughly what the average run play generates. And you get negative 0.08 expected points, which isn't good, of course, but the drop-off here between these two numbers is about half that of the drop-off you saw in the run game. So why do coaches love the run game? Well, if the players do exactly what the coach asks, there's nothing better. The problem is once they don't, nothing drops off more than a bad run play. Thank you for listening to PFF Analytics Short.
All right, some very interesting stuff. Now, the one thing that did surprise me was that we sort of put a lot on the offensive line. You know, I think that everybody says the passing game is more important than the running game, but the actual success rate of a successful run play is the highest expected points added of anything in football. That one totally surprised me. Explain why that is, because if you have a successful run play in which everybody involved in that blocking scheme successfully executes their blocks, it adds 0.27 to your final score. If you can think about it, it adds a quarter of a point to the scoreboard for that game. And if you fail on just one block in the running game, It goes from a positive 0.27 to a negative 0.27. So effectively, the difference in one guy missing a block takes half a point off the scoreboard for your football team.
Yeah, it's amazing, right? Because I think the first thing you talked about underscores why coaches love running the ball. And I think we both played, obviously you played a lot longer than me, but I played, you know, I talked about this on Twitter today, but I said, the look on my offensive line coach's face when we would properly block up zone on film. Like I stopped playing 14 years ago and I still remember that look on his face. Right. And like, that's what these guys are, right? They're engineers of plays, right? And they engineer a play and all the constituent pieces execute it. And when that happens, like you said, if you were to execute that way on every single play throughout the entire year, you would be the most efficient offense in football. 60% of your plays would be successful. You'd average almost, you know, more than a quarter of a point per play, and we'd all be happy, right? And I think that's the ideal that we're all shooting for. The issue though becomes, and again, that's independent of how well the running back runs, by the way, which is, I think, is sort of our, you know, I think we all believe Derrick Henry and Jonathan Taylor and guys like that matter, but for the most part, like the running game, the table is set by the linemen. And like, the problem is you take one block and you make it not work, it tanks a play, right? And it tanks a play, as you said, half of a point, you know, all the way down. It makes your run success down to 1 in 4 plays, which is a far cry from 3 to 5 plays. And the flip side of it is when you throw the football and all of your offensive linemen do really well, your success rate's higher for sure. It's like 53%.
But not as high as a run play, which is at 60%.
Exactly. Because you still, like, everybody knows this. Like, if you block up a pass play, the quarterback still got to hit his back foot and make a throw. The wide receiver still got to make a catch. They got to get open, right? Like, the offensive line is, I would even say, like, it's weird, but like, it's necessary, but not sufficient is kind of the idea. Right. But when you have one negative block or more, it only goes down to 40% success rate. And it only goes down to negative 0.08 expected points. So it's a drop of about a quarter versus a half. And so the idea is that pass plays are a lot less fragile, right? They're a lot less fragile to the play of the offensive line. And it's much more concentrated on the ability of the quarterbacks and the receivers. And that takes, in my opinion, and you could let me know what you think of this, but it takes some of the fun out of coaching, I think, right? When, you know, maybe that's what Belichick got, you know, kind of got cranky at the end of the Brady era and stuff like that. But it's like, if the answer to the question is, well, if Tom executes, we're going to win. And if he doesn't, we won't. Like, I don't know if that's that fun for a coach, right? Versus, look, if I get my backside tackle to scoop this 3 technique and I get the down block from the tight end and the pull from the guard, like, this is beautiful stuff. It's like, sure, but like, it's a trap because your guys can only execute that 1 out of every 3 times. And that's why you see run plays have less success than pass plays, because the ideal is appealing, but it's rarely achieved.
The other part of it though, and it's Jimmy McNally's a friend of mine. He was our offensive line coach in Cincinnati forever and a day. And I used to tell him the same thing all the time. You don't care about anything but the run game. And I'll tell you exactly why. Because the only thing you get measured by are the number of running yards and some proportion to the number of sacks allowed. So if we never threw a pass the entire season, you would have a ton of rushing yards and you would have given up no sacks. I go, for you, you don't even care if we win or not. It doesn't make any difference to you. You're just going to be happy because you got a lot of rushing yards and no sacks. And so we used to go at it pretty good on the sideline, as you can imagine, with that basic philosophy. But it really is. So there's motivation for that. I think if you talk to coaches, the primary reason in their mind, a lot of people's minds, for running the ball is offensive linemen cannot pass protect if they have to do it 50, 60 times a day, because what's the defensive line doing? They're getting in a sprinter stance. It looks like the start of the 100 meters. Here comes these freaky athletes off the edge, as opposed to, let's say, a zone blocking scheme. A zone blocking scheme, the entire offensive line is either moving to the left or the right. So the pass rushers, if you will, are also moving sideways. So if it is a play action pass and they're moving sideways and now you pull it out, they've already taken three steps in the wrong direction before they even think about coming after your quarterback. So protection is key in many ways. But why do, I mean, these guys aren't idiots, right? I mean, head coaches and play callers aren't idiots. So why are they calling running plays at the rate that they do?
I think it's a combination of what you said, which is, and we had Zach Robinson, who now coaches quarterbacks for the Rams. You know, he told me once when we were in the office together, he's like, look, sometimes I just need a mental break. You know, sometimes I need to, you know, it's sort of the equivalent to taking 8 hours of sleep for every 16 hours you're awake. And I buy that a little bit. They aren't idiots and they have evolved, right? When you've seen over time, and I haven't looked at the numbers yet for this year, but you've seen passing efficiency and passing rates in this league increase every single year. So like they are getting the message. They are throwing more than they ever have before. I just think that, you know, the straw man being like, hey, if we never run the ball, like that's never going to happen, right? Like once you start throwing the ball 70, 80% of the time, there's going to be an edge in running the ball. And I think we've even seen it this year where, you know, you look at like Buffalo, they've engineered their defense to stop Kansas City. And who's Buffalo lost to? Titans, Colts, teams that can smash mouth them, right? Because there's always a little bit of a pushback to everything. But I think it's very similar to fourth down stuff. It's just like, you know, in this game, we've learned morals about the game, right? Like, you know, trust your defense, right? You have to establish the run. And there's always an incentive for these coaches to go with the pack, right? Like there's in any field, if you're one of 32 elite people, the incentive shifts oftentimes to failing slowly with everybody else as opposed to failing by yourself because you could get fired more quickly. So I think there's a few like different competing incentives that these folks have. But make no mistake, like more coaches are going for fourth downs, more coaches are throwing the ball. And I think that it's just the rationalization of the game is continuing.
Well, it's because mathematicians like you finally convinced other mathematicians within their organization that what they were doing for 100 years of football was fundamentally wrong. And so guys have adopted the new normal out there. I find it interesting. I was going down PFF's list, and it's one of the things you and I were talking about this today, that the reason I think people come to PFF or people like you, where it truly is, it's not, I think that, you know, which so many programs and so many shows are, some former player or coach. It's like, there's math behind everything we do at PFF. But it's interesting for me, who are the teams that do have the most of those perfectly blocked running plays, right? And so when you put the list together from PFF, number one is Baltimore. They're the number one seed in the AFC. Number two is New England. They're the number two seed in the AFC. Number three is Kansas City. They've won one Super Bowl and been in the other in the last couple of years, and they're one of the hot teams, won four in a row now that their defense is fixed. So there is something to the whole thing as to what happens. And you go, all right, who are the ones that have the most perfectly blocked pass plays? Philadelphia is one. Kansas City is two, and Washington is three. So, I mean, is it more significant, and is it perhaps better coaching that it doesn't matter how much you run, it's how efficiently you run it, because once you plant that seed in their mind that you can run the football, now it's a problem. And Baltimore doesn't even have either of their starting backs from the beginning of the season.
I mean, that's so I think the really interesting part of this, and just looking at the percentages for all of these are still pretty low when you look at the run game, right? Like, I think that's the whole point. Like, I think if a team could have a perfectly blocked run play 60% of the time, I don't think anybody that works in this building would say, hey, stop running the ball. You know what I mean? Like, I think that that's really the hard part is how hard it is to execute that. But yeah, I mean, there's something to, be like, the question that I have about this is how fragile it is to things that change, right? And you look at Baltimore, for example, the fact that they've been able this season to keep up their percentage of perfectly blocked run plays, despite losing Orlando Brown via trade, Ronnie Stanley via an injury, Marshall Yanda, now he retired a couple of years ago. But like, that to me is really the tricky thing, right? Because we talk about continuity on the O-line. We talk about how difficult it is and how fragile it is. And that's really the hard part, right? Like, the thing about throwing is actually it's a relatively trivial problem to get to understand and to predict what one player is going to do. Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, Tom Brady, Mac Jones, those guys. It's really hard to predict what five people are going to do, right? And that fragility is sort of embedding, I think about it as running the ball is like a five-team parlay in betting, which you barely ever win. And throwing the ball is like a one bet straight bet, and that's kind of how that's kind of how I view it. But yeah, if you could find a way to make that five bet parlay be more like even money, I'd run the ball all day.
Well, and that's what people will do. I mean, I can make an argument that people get confused, I think, sometimes when at PFF we talk about running backs don't matter. But it's directly to this point that it's really about the execution of the blocking and the offensive lineman in front of you that matters much more so than who's carrying the ball. So are all these teams better off doing what Kansas City did this year with Trey Smith and Creed Humphrey and going and getting Orlando Brown and rebuilding in that way? New England has a very good offensive line. Baltimore historically, but they've got also Greg Roman's system that is a different sort of system, the same system that Colin Kaepernick used in San Francisco back when they could run the football so effectively. But is the answer ultimately, we should be drafting more offensive linemen. We should build the Dallas Cowboys. We saw the Eagles win the Super Bowl with a great offensive line. Is the answer more people should be paying more attention and spending more money on offensive linemen?
I think so, but I think the hard part is how weak link the system is. And I think that the Chiefs have sort of shown the yarn, the needle you have to thread to make it successful, right? Because they spent big capital on Orlando Brown, and that was good, right? Like, that's ended up being okay for them. Joe Tooney's been wonderful, but he's costly. And what they did is get really lucky in the draft, right? Like, to go 2 for 2 on a second round pick and a sixth round pick is not that probable. And if they were to have like replacement level players at center and right guard, then it certainly matters that Tooney and Brown are on the left side, but it's not like, again, it's about the weakest link, right? And if the weakest link is terrible, then some of the money you spent on the other part of the line might not be as good. And so I had this a person that I talked to with the Chiefs explain it this way. It's like, we know that it's going to be a little bit of wasted money going for Tooney and Brown, but essentially what we're trying to do is guarantee that we get an average player at those two positions, and then we'll take our chances everywhere else. And it's like, in my ideal, you can somehow find an average player at all five positions, but I know that that's not necessarily feasible. But that's kind of where I don't necessarily know if I'd spend top end dollars on anybody on the O-line. I would probably throw third and fourth and second round picks and veteran deals that aren't expensive. I'd throw 10 players at the problem and get my best five, because I know, that's probably a better gamble than taking, spending a ton of money on Tyron Smith, for example, and then he gets injured, and then, you know, all bets are off at that point. That's kind of the tricky thing about all this.
As the number one data analyst in all the land, tell me what still makes you crazy about the game of football. What is it that people still continue to do? We've PFF, I'm just going to take credit for it. We changed everybody's opinion about going for it on fourth down and all of that, which we could do another whole show on that. What is remaining out there that teams still do or don't do that they should be doing based on the numbers?
This sounds really trivial, but it actually has a big effect on the game. I think teams take it out of the end zone on kickoffs way too much.
Between the penalties and the fumbles and the not making it back to the 25-yard line, thank you.
And I know the Big Data Bowl is going on, you know, until January, and it's on special teams, and we helped out with that. And I think, you know, the NFL is really cool for doing that, and we've even gotten people who work for us and interns that have competed in that. But there's somebody who I really respect in the league who messaged me, and he's an analytics person, very sharp. He goes, if all we did was fair catch punts, not get our punts blocked, take a knee on kickoffs, and kick it through the back of the end zone and make our extra points, we'd be ahead of all but like five teams in the league.
I'm telling you, I said that on television one night. I go, all they have to do is not screw it up. Those referees, and you got a bunch of rookies, and they're so desperate to make a block and make an impression to try and stay on the football team or get a chance to start. There's no way they can let somebody run close to them and not put their hands on them. There's no way. And then that guy turns his shoulder slightly. It's a block in the back, and now you're starting from the 10-yard line.
Yeah, and it's not actually their fault, right? Like, I think the problem is, and you know, this is from somebody like the ideal, and like we've all been teachers in some way. You on every Sunday night, me, you know, at university and here and stuff. It's like, at some point you have to face facts at what can be taught and what has to be taught around, right? And to me, expecting the 45th guy on your roster to execute special teams blocks perfectly throughout a season is not reasonable, right? And to me, starting off a possession at the 11-yard line instead of the 25, when all you had to do was take a knee, to me is just like, those are lost points that we'll never get back.
I just know some of the hardest offense to run ever was when you started a drive inside the 20. I mean, you were tentative just going on the field, knowing that one mistake, it's like catching a punt inside the 10 or inside the 20. You know, if you drop that ball, it's points on the board for the other team. And the difference when you're out to the 25, you feel completely free running your offense. And emotionally, it's just such a different thing. So, good. I'm going to keep pounding on that. I've been like, I don't know why they keep bringing it out. Here's another penalty. Here's a fumble. They're giving it to you on the 25-yard line. They already took away a quarter of the field. You don't have to worry about. Let's go. We can beat anybody from the 25. So,
yeah. And if college football is any indication, Bedlam, just don't fair catch punts at the 5. Just stop. Like, let the ball bounce. That was a game where both teams gave up a touchdown because their return men fumbled the ball at the 3-yard line on punts. And I don't know. I returned punts in high school. I'm assuming you did at some point in your career. It's just like, that was the most trivial thing, was to put your heels on the 8 and let the ball go over your head.
I'm going to tell you that the hardest thing I ever did in my sporting career ever was return punts in the SEC. I did it basically the whole time. I returned kickoffs. Kickoffs aren't bad because you can kind of see, although I did take one hit one time on a kickoff, I'll never forget. But on punts, because it wasn't just two people coming down, they could send the house back in the day. And you've got all these high school All-Americans sprinting down at you, trying to make a name for themselves. And very rarely could you catch one and have a little space to operate. And if you dropped it, 9 guys were going to get it before you did. I might be able to beat the punter, or the up back to getting to the ball, but the other nine were going to be on it. That was the one thing in sports that actually did give me pause when I was out there doing that in the SEC. It was hard.
Yeah, I mean, the punt return thing, you have the fair catch, but like all of us are competitors. I think I fair caught like one ball my whole high school career. And, you know, but kickoffs, you're right, like you just have more space and those guys are running faster, but you're also not staring straight into the sky when they hit you.
Oh, God, the wind and the ball twisting in different directions. Oh, hated it. Eric, that was awesome. Thank you, brother. Appreciate all your work at all times. And we will have to do this again.
Of course, Chris, thanks for having me on, and this was a lot of fun.